The increasing heat in our city is a combination of both climate change and development patterns. Because we have more pavement, more air conditioning, more internal combustion vehicles running around, we have higher temperatures in our city than in the surrounding Everglades.
Welcome to this special English edition of Der große Neustart, a German podcast series by Sibylle Barton, in which she talks to pioneering leaders who, inspired by the World Economic Forum's Great Reset Initiative, are committed to making our world smarter, greener, and fairer.
Today, I'm very excited to welcome Jane Gilbert, the world's first chief heat officer. Her task is to prepare for and protect Miami citizens from the heat. Extreme heat is responsible for more death than all other climate-driven disasters in the US combined. We talk about around 12,000 deaths each year. In a few decades, according to a study by the University of Washington, the annual toll could be close to 100,000. And by then, 94% of Miami Beach would be also underwater. Not a small task to manage. Good morning, Jane Gilbert in Miami. How is the weather today?
Oh, it is a beautiful day here in Miami. We are in the mid-70s and sunny. It is gorgeous.
It is gorgeous.
That is why so many people like to live here.
Yeah, of course, which is understandable if we just look at your great weather. However, it is also part of a paradox, which we hopefully will address here during the interview. Let's start with this question that came up during COP26, the UN climate conference in Glasgow. From a climate change perspective, and that was the question, what do Mumbai, Miami, the Maldives, have in common? And of course, you know the answer. They are all at serious risk of being completely submerged. So you, as the world's first chief heat officer, what can you do?
Well, first I want to say I came into this role after having served to the city of Miami as the first chief resilience officer, where we were addressing very much the increasing risks related to sea level rise and the increased flood risks overall. That effort is being done in collaboration. We have a metropolitan government or county runs their airport, port. I should say that one of the reasons Miami is so attractive is we have one of the most active ports and airports in the country. So with huge trade and logistics, big finance sector, and certainly a tourism sector that's very robust. So now the tech sector is catching up with that. We have a very strong health care sector here. But we've done a lot of work, the cities and the county together, on creating plans and implementing plans to address the increasing risks related to sea level rise. You mentioned the whole of the island of Miami Beach getting inundated. Well, that's if we do nothing, right? Without action. But with elevating streets, elevating our coastal infrastructure, and installing improved drainage systems, we actually can live here with and adapt to that change over time, and creating sort of blue-green spaces, as you've seen in the Netherlands. So that's a lot of the work that I came into my current role having done. And as I was doing outreach in the neighborhoods within the city of Miami, which is our downtown urban core, one of the largest concerns of our most vulnerable populations, our socioeconomically vulnerable and disadvantaged populations, is heat. And that came up a lot. It came up a lot as community organizations reached out to those communities to do focus groups and interviews about their top concerns related to climate change. And even though Miami is known internationally for its risk increasing risks related to sea level rise and flood risk. Heat was a super high concern of these populations. In addition, the Adrian Arch Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center, of which Miami-Dade was one of their first community partners, formed an Extreme Heat Resilience Alliance. They saw heat as an emerging threat among cities globally. And it was really out of a conversation between that Arshtrak Resilience Center and our mayor, Daniela Levine-Cava, that the idea of a chief heat officer came to being. My role is to improve coordination and accelerate existing initiatives that either mitigate our urban heat islands or help our communities to manage and prevent heat-related illnesses, and to initiate new initiatives. And I do that in coordination with our office within the county of resilience and sustainability that's focused on both the flooding adaptation and the carbon mitigation. So we work very much together because ideally we want to address solutions that have multiple benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, if you're designing a streetway, you want to design streets that, one, incentivize low carbon mobility and active mobility. In order to do that, you want to be able to provide shade and comfort and carbon sequestration. And if you're doing that, you're also improving the drainage capacity of a street, right? Mm-hmm. So we're looking for solutions that address it. Sometimes it's more challenging. We live in a city that has high penetration and use of air conditioning. And as it gets hotter here every year, people are using that air conditioning more and more, and that creates a lot of waste heat and increases our urban heat island. So in that case, we're really focusing on how do we help particularly our lower income communities retrofit their residences for higher efficiency, so that reduces their energy burden, but keeps them safe in terms of the exposure to heat.
Mm. Before we go into more detail, can we talk a bit about the average temperature and how the temperature plus the humidity have changed over time, let's say, I don't know, last 50 years? Yeah, what kind absolutely. Of an increase was it? Or is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are looking at an average increase of about a degree Celsius. It's about 2 degrees, a little over 2 degrees Fahrenheit, so about a degree in Celsius since 1985. And how that translates. So to your point, Miami's heat is a combination of temperature and humidity. And because our body has a harder time regulating heat when it's very humid. So whereas the Southwest of the United States can have temperatures, you know, well over 100, you know, in the 120s, we never get temperatures over 100. But
we talk about 39 degrees Celsius, right? Around?
Yes, probably. Correct. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you for that translation.
No, sorry. I had to translate it from Europe here. Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Hmm? Absolutely. So here you're going to have to help me. At 90 degrees heat index, we have that currently about half the year. And that goes, and then we have a heat index of 105 right now on average, historically, about 7 days a year. And that is when it's really dangerous for anyone to be outside for an extended period of time.
But so by there sorry to interrupt, but here we talk about around 40 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so 40 degrees Celsius heat index. The combination of temperature and humidity. That 7 days average a year is expected to increase to 88 days a year by mid-century, almost 3 months. So So we're talking about a much longer period of time where our days are really very difficult. Now, for people like me that work inside air conditioning, I can adapt. But for those that are outdoor workers, construction workers, large agricultural community here, landscapers, public safety professionals, a crossing guard at a school, you know, all of these are exposed to heat and need to be able to function through the day, or summer camps, kids in summer camp. This is going to start to present more and more of a challenge for our community to adapt. So that's really what we're looking at is, and the increasing heat in our city is a combination of both climate change and development patterns. Because we have more pavements, more air conditioning, more internal combustion vehicles running around, we have higher temperatures in our city than in the surrounding Everglades by probably in centigrade about 5 degrees centigrade.
And what consequence does it have for people's health?
So heat can impact us in many ways, and we don't have it well documented because many times it's recorded as a heart attack or a stroke or a kidney failure, all of which could have actually been caused or certainly exacerbated by heat exposure. But so you can have cramps, you know, on the light end, you could have cramps, you could have faint or pass out, you could have heat exhaustion. When it gets very dangerous and in danger of a fatality of the heat stroke, when your body really shuts down, gets a temperature over 104, then you're quite at risk. Pete, there are certain people that are more vulnerable. Pregnant women, young children are more vulnerable, and really pregnant women can also have preterm births as a result of overexposure to heat. Older adults are more vulnerable, people on certain prescription medications, and certainly people with pre-existing conditions related to heart disease, diabetes, lung, COPD, all of them are more vulnerable to the exposures of heat.
You mentioned earlier that, of course, you have the luxury of air conditioning, and of course, anybody who can afford air conditioning will do. But with the increasing energy prices and everything, how do people manage? What does it mean to the living standard?
So people are adjusting their, keeping their AC off at night to save costs if they're having a hard time even paying rent. Let alone the utility bills. And our utility bills are going up not only because the heat is going up, but because the prices are going up and per unit use. So it is a big challenge. And if you imagine those lower income residents may also be outdoor workers. So they're getting exposed to the heat throughout the day, and then they're coming home and they can't afford to cool themselves down. Well, if they can't, you know, one of the biggest risks is not being able to cool down at night. And if they can't afford that, that can be very, very challenging. So they try to manage with opening the windows and fans, and you can do a lot with that. You can drape, you know, wet towels over you that'll help to evaporate. All of that are techniques that can definitely help, and people do know how to, they're quite resilient in that way. However, it in some cases isn't enough. Chronic exposure can result in challenges.
And how do you address it? I think you mentioned it in a previous interview that You have around 300,000 outdoor workers. That is a big number. How do you help them?
So we actually had a workshop earlier this week with 90 participants. Some were outdoor workers or representatives of unions, some were employers, some were researchers, to discuss this very issue. We have currently pending state legislation that would provide protection for outdoor workers. Right now, there are no occupational health and safety regulations around heat. They are obligated, employers are obligated to provide a safe environment, but it is not, and there are guidelines for what that safety means in terms of heat exposure. But there are no regulations. These proposed regulations would require employers to provide training programs for both managers and employees, and to put in place procedures to make sure that they have potable water available at the work site, that they provide a 10-minute break every 2 hours at a minimum for any day that's over 90 degrees, and that they have emergency procedures on site. So if someone starts to show signs of heat stress, heat exhaustion, they can immediately take them off the work site and address those from a medical standpoint. So we're hoping that that will get passed at the state level. It would be much harder for us to pass that kind of policy here locally because we don't have a Department of Labor. We don't have a way to enforce it. But even in the absence of that, we are looking to design a campaign to raise awareness amongst both employees and employers about what they really need to be doing. And it would protect their bottom line, even without the regulations, because there are risks in terms of workmen's compensation insurance increases, lost time on the job, turnover, et cetera. Unless if they protect the workers, they can reduce all of those costs. So there are incentives. We're going to look to recognize those employers that are doing the right thing and also call out those that might be identified as not doing the right thing, so that we can raise the level of awareness and hopefully best practices here.
Maybe we can talk a bit and you can talk and you can take us through today's situation. I saw that you have developed an extreme heat toolkit, or you also have set up a health task force and even there was talk about resilience hubs. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. So when I was hired for this position in that last summer, the two things I wanted to do first was certainly during the summer, quickly start raising awareness about the dangers of heat in partnership with our National Weather Service, through all our public facilities, our parks, our police, our library system, our social media handles, et cetera. But then I also wanted to create a toolkit. We have 34 municipalities within Miami-Dade County that they could also use this toolkit to begin thinking about their policies and procedures, whether it's around increasing green infrastructure or putting more shade at bus stops, around playgrounds, or it's addressing from a more management standpoint of informing the residents, informing outdoor workers, informing residents of what they can do to increase efficiency in their homes, and training disaster volunteers to be those first responders in the event of extreme heat time. So we're doing that, and we formed a 15-member diverse task force. We're currently, the idea is to develop a region-wide plan of action for the next 3 years And right now we're having a series of public workshops, each focusing on a different aspect of how we either mitigate urban heat or help people to manage that inevitable heat. So we had one focused on data and research, one on public education and outreach, one on emergency management and response. This week we had one focused on outdoor workers. Our next two are going to be focused on housing and then streets and trees. And then out of that, we will put together that three-year action plan.
It's fascinating. It's a massive amount of work, and it works from what you were saying, mainly in the multi-stakeholder approach here. And there's nothing you can do on your own, really, is there?
Yes, we have our health department, our National Weather Service, our university sector, nonprofit sector, chambers of commerce. We have them all involved.
Miami is actually certainly for me more known for its hurricanes and floods and wildfires, and I know that you got shelters for floods and wildfires, but you also were saying that you want to create, or maybe you have created already, those heat shelters. And how do they differ from the others? What are the needs?
So just to back up, we in Miami have many decades of experience in responding to hurricanes because of vulnerability. And we have designated evacuation shelters for those that might be in harm's way from a storm surge, or they feel that their house can't withstand the wind storm. And so those shelters are my first concern, is that we need to make sure they have the backup power in the event of, they all have backup power, but only to keep the lights on in essential functions that doesn't include keeping the shelter itself cool. Our hurricane season is our summer months, is during our summer months. So in the event of a widespread extended power outage, we need to make sure we can keep those shelters cool. So that's a big line of defense. And those are generally high schools throughout the county. Then secondly, we have at our park and library facilities, they've been designated as cooling centers where people can go during hot times of the day to cool off if they don't have access to AC at home. And those are often also serve as points of distribution in the aftermath of a hurricane, or in prep of a hurricane, for getting water and ice, for notifying of services. So they serve multifunctions already. Our goal with the Resilience Hub Network is to take that to another level. These are already recognized, trusted community facilities in neighborhoods, that in the event of any kind of disaster, it's a place where people can congregate, they can charge their phone, they could access water, ice, food. It can also serve the function in terms of preparation and education before any event. And in the event of this extended power outage and hot time, what we want to do is make sure they have the energy redundancy, ideally through solar power and a battery backup, because again, we want to seek multiple benefits. We don't want to exacerbate our climate change problem with our resilient solutions. To make sure that they have the backup power, so that our residents, if they don't have backup power and we have that widespread power outage, they have a place to go to cool off in their own neighborhood.
And those shelters and hubs, are they reality, or are you still in planning?
So our within the city of Miami, when I was chief resilience officer, we created a resilience hub network plan, and they've already started to invest. They've got a state grant to retrofit one park facility, and then they're installing it as part of a new construction facility in another area of the city. At the county level, we partnered with our Strzok Resilience Center again on a planning grant from the state of Florida. And so we're just kicking off that planning process for which facilities would be the top priority for investments and what those design criteria really need to be.
Mm-hmm. And I just remember that especially during Glasgow, there was also a lot of talk about trees and the importance of trees, clearly. And I read that in Miami's lower income, mostly Black and Latino neighborhoods, tree cover can be as little as 10%, compared to around 40% in upscale coastal areas. So, I mean, I know I'm a bit sharp now, but does life and death depend currently on people's race and zip code?
So it is very aligned with certainly income levels. And you know, we're a diverse city throughout. So the race ethnicity is not as correlated as it is just to income. And but it's certainly, you know, an issue that we're recognizing. But the county has had a goal. Our average tree canopy is 20%. Our goal is to get to 30%. Mm-hmm. In the last 6 years, we've remained at 20%, which you could say is highly disappointing, which it is, but we also have had major tree losses from hurricanes and from our just increasing development overall. So it's, you know, maintaining 20% takes a lot of effort, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
So our goal now is to design a set of procedures, policies, et cetera, that really move us to increase, particularly focusing on those areas that are 10% or less in our county. But there are often many challenges that come up with that. These are often neighborhoods that don't have a lot of space, either in the right of way or on the private land for trees. And we need to make sure they're planted well, that they're the right tree, that they're not going to blow down in a windstorm and take a power line with them. We have the resources to maintain them, or the neighborhood has the resources to maintain them, because otherwise we're just if the efforts are futile. You can't take care of that tree if it can't thrive over time. You're losing the benefits, the multiple benefits of trees. So it is. I wish it could be just, you know, okay, let's plant a bunch of trees, but we have to, there's a lot to negotiate in terms of where, what type of tree, where that's placed, how it's the surrounding pedestrian walkway and streets can accommodate it.
Can I ask you about your budget? Are you able to talk about it? Whether there is really enough financial support that you can make an impact?
Yeah. Well, you know, my position was created initially because the mayor just wanted to get it going as soon as possible as a consulting position. We're now working on a permanent position with an assistant. And I've had a small budget just to get this planning going and get some initial public education and emergency management enhancement response. But ideally, if my work is successful, it's really through the budgets of our Department of Transportation and Public Works, our housing and human services departments, and our HR departments, and our emergency management and parks. it's really through my role is essentially a role of coordination and catalyst and accelerating the work that needs to be done through these larger departments with much more capacity than I, you know, would have in my particular office. So it's hard for me to answer that question because it is really through not only all those departments I mentioned in the county, but through our other city partners, through our state health department, and our nonprofit and university partners. So it's really through increasing commitment for resources on all those ends.
If you think about, I mean, to have this role, do you feel like a role model? I mean, shortly after your new job was implemented, we had Phoenix and a chief heat officer in Athens in Greece, or in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Do you think there are more following?
I know there are more following. Los Angeles City Council voted to hire a chief heat officer. There's been other cities and towns that have reached out for more information about how the position is set up and what the responsibilities are. So I know there will be additional heat officers in other cities, which isn't to say you have to have a heat officer in order to address the issues. I work very closely with our Office of Resilience and Sustainability, and really in many cities, that is, like New York has done great work on addressing heat. It's all done through their Offices of Resilience and Sustainability. So I think there are different ways a city can resource this work. Sometimes it can be through an emergency management department. But the unique benefit of a chief heat officer is that singular focus on this particular issue and the ability to coordinate across departments. I'm in the mayor's office.
I think most countries have signed the UN climate agreement, including the US. Do you feel that, just looking at Miami now and your work, that you're addressing the roots of climate change enough? Because from what you tell me, I know you're fighting the heat and you help people and things like that. Is there parallel an equal effort to help the climate?
Absolutely. First, I would say back in my role at City of Miami, we not only had that climate adaptation plan, which we had to do first because it was our immediate threat, but then the focus was on what's the carbon mitigation plan? Given that we are the tip of the spear in terms of vulnerability to climate change, we owe it to ourselves and to the world to also demonstrate leadership in terms of carbon mitigation. And so we put that in place at the City of Miami. The county has also released their climate action strategy, and they have a whole team within the Office of Resilience focused on carbon mitigation. I, with the Chief Resilience Officer for the county, Jim Murley, and I were on a clean energy task force for our school district. We have the fourth largest school district in the country here. And it is a very large consumer of electricity, and their bus network uses a huge amount of diesel gas. They set a very ambitious goal of 100% clean energy in their buildings and their transportation by 2030, in eight years. So we had to help them come up with that plan. We just presented that to the school board this month. So there is a deep commitment here towards carbon mitigation. And as I mentioned earlier, that's why it's critical that the actions that I come up with also contribute towards that goal, not exacerbate it.
I also recently, your mayor announced a new action plan. I read a bit. Can you tell me what's in the action plan?
The climate action plan?
Yeah, I think it's called Thrive 305.
Oh, the Thrive 305 plan. Yes, yeah. She did. So there is a big focus on overall resilience in that. There's a big focus. Her four, broad priorities are around protecting our environment, enhancing our economy, in addressing equity issues, and improving engagement. So that plan was developed with extensive engagement on priorities throughout our county of 2.7 million people. And so it's a broad plan around addressing public safety. We had some, uptick in our homicide rate. So there's a lot of concern around public safety, a lot around access to living wage jobs and equity issues, health equity as well. And then also the environmental work of carbon mitigation, protecting our Biscayne Bay, and working on resilience overall.
And how close do you work with business, with companies?
So I was on the phone this morning and yesterday with various companies that are helping us to create innovations, whether it's to improve our data gathering network with sensors in various neighborhoods and different work sites, et cetera, to really understand the microclimates and how that heat impacts us. Innovations in cool pavements, cool roofs, cool building materials. I talked to them about pilots for that. And then also around any innovations with building efficiency.
So far from everything you're saying, it sounds really great. I wonder whether there's anything missing where you say we need to address factor A, B, C much more strongly, or the national government needs to be more involved. It's an overall problem. Or can you manage on your own?
Oh, I definitely cannot manage on my own. That is, I know. I'm not sure any of us can, to be honest. I need the national government's help, and I have them at the table, whether it's improving our communication and warning systems through the National Weather Service. They're absolutely engaged, and we're in discussion.
What does
there.
It mean? Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So right now, the thresholds for the National Weather Service to issue a heat warning here, or a heat advisory first and then a heat warning, is the thresholds are a heat index of 108 and then 113. Well, most hospitalizations and we rarely hit those levels. Most hospitalizations and heat-related illnesses happen at levels far lower than that. And, it could be even just over a heat index of 90, depending on how much that individual was exerting themselves and how vulnerable they are to heat. So we're working with them on what is an easy way to communicate different levels of risk so that people know today is a yellow day, and that yellow day means you do this, or tomorrow is going to be an orange day. So that means that you may, if you're going to work out, you probably don't want to work out during the hours of 1 to 3, and or make sure you take breaks every so often, drink this much water, et cetera, so that there's guidelines for people, that we don't have to wait until it is that extreme emergency to communicate the risks. So that's something that we're trying to get. We're doing updated, the first heat health vulnerability assessment for Miami-Dade County, and that will help inform that work. That's something that we're working on a pilot with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, which has the National Weather Service, so for that work. But we need the Occupational Safety and Health Administration through the Department of Labor to speed up. The Biden administration has called for regulations, guidelines on heat, but it can take a very long time for them to push that through, which is why we're trying to push the state legislation. So we need the federal government. We need their help with all the building retrofits that we need to do here, certainly at the state level as well. We're working with the state, as I mentioned, on the Resilience Hub Network. We, as a metropolitan government, don't control all the cities within it at all, levels. So we need to be in partnership with them. So it really takes, it does take a village to address this work.
Yeah. Do you think we need new national standards to in order to protect people in the longer term? Is your government doing enough to support the needs of its people?
I think the current Biden administration is doing everything they can to push forward that agenda. It's been limited by Congress, its ability to do that. And for instance, the Build Back Better bill that they've proposed, it's now getting cut back. It had a lot of opportunities to expand housing retrofits, to expand tree planting, to expand healthy streets. That could be cut back to expand its data platforms, etc. So that could be cut back by Congress. So there has been a limitation as to what this administration can do. They're doing everything. I feel they're listening to us. They've reached out for more information on what they need to be doing. Certainly how they support each community. Our carbon mitigation challenge is a global challenge that should have global standards, national standards. Climate adaptation is very local, and it affects communities very differently. So that's much harder to come up with just one national standard on how you support that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you with the global standards, but we have everything in place. I mean, we have the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which they all signed in 2015. Now it's 2022. What do you reckon? If you carry on with all the enthusiasm and all the other stakeholders you have by your side, if you look ahead in 20 years' time, how do you think life could look like in Miami?
So I am a firm believer that our biggest challenges also present great opportunities to rethink how we live, move, and play in the city and work. And so I believe that if we can focus on how do we build a mobility network that promotes healthy living, that promotes access to jobs, that promotes pedestrian interaction, and that we concentrate our populations around areas that are higher elevation, that can have mixed use and mixed income. You know, there's great opportunity to rethink urban design and encourage communities that are the kind that have a improved quality of life, and allow for our lower lying areas, perhaps some of the lower lying areas where we can't support the investment, like Miami Beach. It's already so built up, and there's, you know, great value in all of that real estate. Through that, they can afford to elevate everything. Certain areas, we're not going to have that level of taxpayer investment. So we need to allow those areas to turn more blue-green and concentrate our populations along higher ground where we can have strong transit infrastructure and really reduce both our carbon footprint, but hopefully improve access to jobs and open space.
Yeah. When you think back, I saw that you studied environmental science at Barnard College in New York, which was probably great. How much did it prepare you for your current role?
I think it was an excellent preparation. If I had known that these jobs would have been available then, I would have pursued them way back then after graduating. I think, you know, one, studying environmental science within the urban context of New York City was hugely valuable education. And two, and I think environmental science, in and of itself as a discipline, forces that interdisciplinary thinking, not only within the sciences themselves, because to be a strong environmental scientist, you have to have foundation in geology, biology, chemistry, really all the sciences. But also you need to have a strong foundation in policy and economics.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Social psychology.
Yeah.
So that degree at Barnard recognized that, and I was able to learn environmental policy through history. We had to look at problems through those interdisciplinary lenses and design solutions in that way. And I think that was just an outstanding training for what I do now.
How do you think? How aware and awake are people in Miami to all the threats that are around them?
We're pretty aware. It's sort of hard to deny, both when we get, you know, small floods on a Sunday day, or, you know, that, as I mentioned, I've been here 25 years. I feel our summers are hotter and longer than they used to be. And I know that my peers know, you know, my fellow residents have felt the same. So there's a general awareness, certainly, you know, the majority of our population is struggling every day to make ends meet. And so it's sort of not high on their priority list as a result. So that's the challenge, is that, you know, they're looking to put food on the table, get their kids to school, make sure they can pay their bills. And so their capacity for focusing on these issues is more limited.
After everything we talked about now, at the same time, and that's kind of a paradox, we have the property market, the prices rising in Miami. And we have the tech have kind of a love affair with Miami, and the crypto enthusiasts are there and coming. And I think I even saw that they think it will be the next Silicon Valley. How does it work? Do you understand it?
Not fully. I mean, I understand the attraction to be here, absolutely, for all the reasons I said earlier. And I love it here. I'm highly invested in trying to make it work here. And I'm not alone in that front. Mm-hmm. It does have some cognitive dissonance to see the level of excitement and growth when we are as vulnerable as we are. But I've also had meetings with large investment firms, the real estate investment firms, which gain great confidence to see how much our local governments are working to address these issues. And that's helped, I think, continue to build that investment. And I now need to wrap it up because my daughter is at the door.
Okay. I think we covered most of the important issues, and we all understood the importance of your role protecting Miami citizens from the heat. I wish you a lot of energy and even more optimism. And of course, thanks for taking the time talking to us.
I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. It's through global conversations like this that give me hope that we can do it if we stay focused and open to working together.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special English edition of Der große Neustart, a German podcast series by Sibylle Barton, in which she talks to pioneering leaders who are committed to making our world smarter, greener, and fairer. For more information, please visit www.sibyllebarton.com and the official site of the World Economic Forum.